everyone. Welcome to another bonus episode of the Geek Warning Podcast from the Escape Collective. I'm James Huang, and a few weeks ago, we brought you a super in-depth interview with Jonathan Kennedy at Framework Bicycles in Hamilton, Ontario. If you haven't listened to that one yet, you absolutely want to go back and bookmark that one, because it really is pretty mind-blowing what he's doing pretty much all by himself over there. During that same trip, though, I also paid a visit to the folks at Bridge Bike Works in nearby Toronto, Ontario, and that's the subject of this week's members-only Geek Warning show. Bridge put a pretty hefty task in front of them when they established their business just a few years ago, and that task being manufacturing carbon frames in Toronto, as in, like, actually making stuff, not just, like, designing here and making over there. Even more impressive is the fact that they're making their own carbon forks, too, which, like, apparently nearly broke them in the process, because making carbon forks is actually pretty darn hard. So what exactly is involved in turning nearly 800 pieces of prepreg carbon fiber into a complete frame set? And, like, why is making a carbon fork so hard? Why did Toronto end up actually being maybe the perfect place to kick something like this off? Well, if you want to find out more, you'll have to keep listening to my interview with Bridge co-founders Frank Gardner and Mike Yakubovich. Keep in mind, though, that this is a members-only episode, and it's only going to be available in full to Escape Collective members. It's a big show, too. It's about 100 minutes, so lots of information here. The rest of you, unfortunately, are going to get cut off somewhere in the middle and, like, probably just when it starts to get good. So if you're already a member, thanks for being part of the Escape Collective. And if not, head over to escapecollective.com/join before you get too sucked in. Don't say I didn't warn you. All right, on with the show. Frank and Mike, thanks so much for joining me on the show today. Just so people listening can kind of get familiarized with who you are and your voices and stuff like that, would you mind just please introducing yourselves and maybe tell a little bit, what exactly do you do here?
Thanks, James. My name is Frank Gardner. I'm one of the co-founders of Bridge Bike Works.
And I'm Michael Yakubovich, the other co-founder. I guess my background quickly is I've run a shop in Toronto called Blacksmith Cycle for about 13 years. We specialize in high-end custom design bikes. And I really handle more of what happens outside the factory. So kind of design, PR, sales, marketing. And Frank really runs the shop.
So Frank, what were you doing before Bridge?
Before Bridge, I actually started a series of manufacturing companies locally here in Toronto. And the emphasis on all of those is really just doing something new and creative, a bit of, market disruptors in some ways. And from those experiences, I learned a lot about machine shops. I learned a lot about how shops should be set up and established, and also had a deep dive into composites. So my last job before this was called Carbon Marine, and we made fully composite power boats. And so I had a really deep dive into the world of composites with that in the marine space. And then after that, I really just wanted to make something that I could buy, for one. The boats were pretty spendy. And so wanted to make something that I could use myself as an avid cyclist. And also it was just kind of a challenge once I started looking around in the Canadian manufacturing space for carbon bikes. There was pretty much none to speak of other than We Are One out west, which is a fantastic company. And so it was really just that impetus of learning a lot about how to manufacture things, learning a lot about composites production, and also just being a passionate cyclist. And then the industry landscape, which was pretty barren, was kind of enough for me to just get really interested in the possibilities of starting a frame production company.
So I think it's one thing to say or to have the desire to kind of do all those things that you mentioned, Frank, and, you know, look for a composite bike that's made here in Canada. It's kind of a big jump to go from just kind of having that idea to be like, we should start a bike company. So how did that come about?
Well, a bit of it's mixed up into, again, my history of making things. So again, I was kind of used to making big and bold and potentially stupid decisions. And so I was kind of accustomed to that state of just being, you know, not risk adverse and wanting a challenge. And almost the more challenging it is, the more I want to do it, for better or worse, just because I want to prove, one, that it can be done, and two, I want to prove that we can do it here and build the skill sets here. And I don't see anything more valuable than doing as much as you possibly can under one roof, because otherwise you're exporting your expertise, you're exporting your knowledge, your trade secrets are just on paper or transferred online. Like, they're not being built within your actual company. And so I just saw that as a much more valuable thing to pursue than, you know, basically just a sales, marketing, warehousing company type thing.
So why is it important to both of you, I guess, to build bikes here in Canada?
I would say for starters, the importance there is, again, skill set generation. I think it's really important for every country to build skill sets in making things. I think things are, don't get me wrong, I'm not a anti-tech person, but you know, a lot of people are growing up just behind computers or basically just learning how to direct other people to do things. Whereas I think it's absolutely incredibly important to build those skill sets locally. Aside from that, it's about quality control. It's about being able to understand what you're making, how you make it. And I think you can almost by definition, assuming you're doing things right, make a better product because you know everything about it. I mean, there's no other possibility of a better outcome in my mind if you control it all. Again, this all assumes that you're doing the right thing and making the right choices. But if you have a team and you have leadership that's dedicated towards making the best thing possible and obsessed with it, the outcome is going to be a better product. And I think the industry deserves that. And I think people want it.
Yeah, it's interesting. I think anytime I've kind of broached this subject with other people, yeah, I think the public perception for a lot of stuff like this, it's often like a national pride sort of thing, or like certainly like a secrecy, trade secret sort of thing, intellectual property, that sort of thing. But when I talk to the companies that are actually doing it, they almost without fail, they all bring up the stuff that you were just talking about with kind of just having more control over your whole process. So in that sense, you know, you both are here in Toronto. So I think you're both personally vested in having it here, but would those same things apply wherever you happen to be, you think?
I think it does in general, and everything really depends on the team surrounding it and kind of the ethos of the company doing it. Like I think a lot of things have to match up for the local play to be impactful. But yeah, I think any time that a country is making their own things, it's valuable to that country itself and to the skill sets of the people that are in it, for sure. Location just happens to be where we are, and obviously our landscape was not as fruitful as the US or some other countries with respect to manufacturing carbon fiber frames. So that was an opportunity for us. But at the same time, there's space for more. You know, it's not, hopefully there's space for many more, and we can make an impact and prove to other people that they can do it too, and welcome them and even help them out. And like, it's been a very generous industry so far of people who make it on this continent. I mean, and beyond, actually, we all talk frequently. We're all very supportive. And understand that there's, you know, much more space for many others of us to exist, and hopefully some of our bushwhacking and those who bushwhacked before us, you know, can convince people to make that jump and build a much more diverse offering of local product.
The one thing I'll say about being based in Toronto is we, in the end, I don't think we realized this at the outset, but had a really deep pool of talented individuals located close to us.
With applicable talent, no less.
Definitely. And that's, you know, very, very niche talent at that. So, you know, Cervelo was originally based in Toronto. So there was a pretty amazing collection of talent of people who'd worked in the kind of design and engineering side. And we've got some of those in-house already. And then on top of that, I would say composite production, that Ontario's actually got a pretty big industrial sector, especially related to automotive. So, you know, having people who are super skilled in terms of composite production, whether they've worked in aerospace or the automotive industry, really allowed us to hire an amazing team locally. We didn't have to import our talent from across North America, but we had really incredible opportunities to bring people in early on. And it seems like there's a super deep pool of talent locally that we've been able to add to the team as we've grown.
I'd say one of the other big steps that Mike and I went through too was the whole question of would another bike in the industry just add to the noise? You know, there's a lot of offerings out there. Of course, anybody that just searches carbon bike, or they're going to see how many options there are. But our answer was, well, if you take away all of the bikes that are made overseas, is it still adding noise? And our answer to that was no, it's not. I mean, there's let's call it 5 to 6 companies in North America that are doing relatively what we're doing, which is not a lot of options. And if you're a purchaser, it's not going to take you very long to search through those options and figure out which brand aligns with you the best, which product aligns with you the best. And so our answer to that was it wasn't adding that noise. It was in a very particular market segment, perhaps nichey, but one that we were passionate to grow. And also we're okay with niche. Like we are not trying to sell 30,000 of these a year. So niche is totally fine for us. So our answer to that was no, it's not adding noise. And on top of that, basically made the assumption that there is a gap from consumer to let's say producer or manufacturer or seller of the causal chain of how their thing was made. You know, in our impression, a lot of people are kind of riding their bikes with this veil of marketing, maybe I could say, of they think that that company actually made it. And even if they don't actually think that, when you talk to them, it's almost like this veil of this is an awesome piece of manufacturing from this company in North America, when it's really not. And you know, the vast majority of them aren't. And everything else around us, for people, especially in our industry, they're much more focused on local food production, local clothing production, environmental awareness, all of the stuff that's rising, but yet they're riding something that doesn't represent any of that. And so we thought that even though that's hard to market and it's hard to, you know, we don't want to poo-poo on anyone else. They're doing great stuff. And obviously everything has its place and consumers have their choice. But in our minds, there's definitely a segment of people who deeply appreciate that causal connection, the chain of custody, let's say, of how something was made and what they're sitting on.
I think it's very safe to say that, for sure, there are a lot of bike companies out there, certainly a lot of carbon bike companies out there. I mean, I'm obviously coming at this from the outside, but looking at it from that perspective, if you had two people whose primary motivation was to kind of just start up a new bike brand, get that whole thing off the ground, it certainly seems like it would have been a lot easier to just kind of go the conventional route and like come up with a design and find a contract manufacturer overseas somewhere and be like, you know, hand it over and be like, hey, build this.
Yeah, I mean, honestly, there's a plus and a minus to everything. And there's definitely days or weeks or months where I'm like, man, this would have been so much easier if someone else was making this. There's no doubt. But then again, at the end of the day, that's one, not what we wanted and just wouldn't have been what we started. The number one reason why we did this, because we wanted it this way. So that was kind of just clear from the beginning. It was never an option for us to offshore. And I have had experience with offshoring some products before for local assembly. It comes with its own headaches, like massive amounts of headaches of quality control, lead times. As we saw through COVID, obviously that was a major reminder of controlling your own supply chain and or just making your own stuff, is how important that is to have that control. Again, it goes back to control, yes, on product, but also on everything that you're doing. I mean, if you're just a business that's reliant purely on something that's coming across sea, that's a pretty big risk element in my mind. And it obviously, when it's going well and going smooth, I mean, it seems like the most obvious thing to do. Sometimes it doesn't run that way and it goes in the opposite direction where you have to send your engineers overseas and you have, in my mind, a dislocation of the fundamentals of the company where people are traveling all over just to get one thing made. And then you're getting boxes of your product that somebody else made that, you know, you got to put together and ship. And again, that wasn't really what Mike and I had in mind of what would give us pride in what we were doing.
I think from my perspective also, you know, I through my shop, I do sell a lot of bikes that are made domestically, but they tend to mostly be steel and titanium bikes. You know, there's a lot of amazing builders from Mosaic and on the Thai side, number 22 to Stinner and you know, you could go on and on about great bikes that are made in North America, but not a lot of good carbon bikes made in North America. And as Frank said, you know, most of the big companies have really become more design and marketing firms, and then everything is basically produced by the same handful of factories overseas. And obviously there's, you know, a decades long history there and there's a template and they do it well. But I think for us, we kind of looked at the landscape and said, you know, that we thought there was a gap in terms of companies that are really still trying to design and engineer at a really high level and aim for building a performance bike and not just an art piece, but then produce it in-house with a really high level of attention to detail and care and technology. So, you know, that combination is really what we thought was lacking in the marketplace. And for someone who wants a performance product that doesn't really have compromises compared to the bigger brands that you see marketed heavily, but that also has the attention to detail, the local manufacturing, the quality, the fact that we do everything in-house from cutting our own tools to start the process, to painting the bikes, to end the process. That combination of attributes we thought you don't see in a lot of other manufacturing facilities in North America. and certainly not in the bigger companies who aren't building here at all.
Well, that actually kind of feeds in perfectly to what I wanted to talk to you about next here, because I mean, part of the story here for sure is just the fact that you're making bikes in Toronto. I mean, it seems like that in and of itself clearly is pretty unusual. But aside from geography, what is it you would say sets Bridge apart? Like, you know, what were your goals in that sense as far as what you wanted this thing to be?
Well, I mean, maybe we each have our different angle. Frank probably more on the manufacturing side and me maybe a little more on the design and performance side. But I would say for me at the outset, I think most brands are marketing their products pointing to how pro racers are riding them. You know, we've got a world tour team or we're sponsoring this gravel pro, and so you should ride our bike. And for me, the longer I've been in the industry, the more I've kind of felt that's disingenuous for most consumers. You know, if you look at what cars we buy, very few of us are going out and buying a Mercedes because Lewis Hamilton races a Formula One car. Certainly not a Ferrari.
That comes next year.
Yeah. But, you know, for us at the outset, really, I think we're trying to build a phenomenal bike for high-end consumers. And that doesn't mean performance takes a backseat. You know, most of us who ride hard and want to go fast and want to have fun and have something that's reactive and playful and an amazing experience on the road. But it also allows us to be really authentic about the kind of bike we're trying to build and the attributes of, you know, characteristics that we really think impact the end result for a consumer, not trying to build something for a world tour team that we then tell people, well, you should ride this because Peter Sagan's riding it. So, you know, that means we can really look at every attribute of the bike and sort of make an honest decision about whether we think it's merited or not. You know, so if I took two kind of examples on different ends of the spectrum, we do have a fully internal cable routing system. So you can run totally clean cables. I think most consumers really like that look. There's a little bit of a performance attribute in terms of aerodynamics, but a lot of it is aesthetic and just having a super clean bike. That being said, we built it in a non-proprietary way where you can still run a semi-external system, which is a little easier for travel and working on your own bike. But at the other end of the spectrum, we have a round 27.2 seat post with an external seat collar. And that was a decision kind of looking at, you know, other bikes in the market. And most big brands are using some sort of internal wedge type system for the seat collar. And yes, it looks a little cleaner and maybe there's a half a watt of aerodynamic savings there. But for people who work on bikes, there's lots of problems with those systems. You know, you have wedges that bind, you have wedges that don't hold the seat post right. I've seen plenty of frame sets that have had to get warrantied because people over torque the wedge and then crack the frame and then basically your bike is garbage. So, you know, we're really able to look kind of feature by feature on the bike and say, does this make sense for the consumer? And so for us, a round seat post, which is comfortable, manufacturable, will have very low warranty rates, which is light also. We don't have to chase every trend because, oh, every other world tour team has drop seat stays, so we need drop seat stays too. We really can go through the list of attributes and make decisions that we think relate to the people who are actually riding the bikes and not just how we're going to market the bike. So really at the outset, I'd say what sets us apart in some ways is building a really high performance product, but that's aimed for the consumer and, you know, not aimed at how we're going to market it.
I mean, I'm definitely not going to disagree with any of what you said there. Although I think for people who are pretty well aware of what other stuff is out there, it also seems like a lot of that could be said of other brands that have taken a more conventional route as far as where and how stuff is being made. Like when you were talking about that, when one bike that popped in my head is like that Rita Esprit, for example. Like it had carbon bike made overseas, hidden routing up front, round seat post, threaded bottom bracket. Like it definitely a lot of elements of kind of consumer friendliness and maintenance practicality, stuff like that. But it's a very different bike. It's certainly a very different story. So it feels like there's another big piece of this because, again, like from a technical aspect, there's sort of the feature thing. But what are you all doing about all the stuff that people can't see, like the stuff that's hidden under the paint?
For sure. I mean, yeah, the ability to choose attributes is just a small part of how we design the bike. But I think the bigger part of our story is how we build the bike. Again, we thought there was a bit of a gulf between brands that are performance oriented, but also trying to produce at an ultra high level. For me, a brand like Parley, for example, they're one of the kind of North American carbon pioneers. Beautiful bikes, but have always been sort of on the very, call it conservative or old school side of the spectrum, you know, like lugged carbon design, really nice ride quality, but not a lot of focus on aerodynamics, weight, stiffness, performance. So for us, trying to marry those two sides and say we want to design a performance bike like a big brand would, but then produce it at a much higher quality. And at the end of the day, if you're spending many thousands of dollars on a bike, there should be a quality that matches that price point. Being able to build it here and concentrate at a very high level on the build quality, on the technology, about how we build our parts, how we finish the bikes, we just think we can build a better bike here. You know, you hear manufacturers talking about EPS foam as if that's a really high-end way to build a frame. The answer is it's really not. And, you know, there's much better ways of getting compaction, latex bladders, silicone mandrels, 3D printed mandrels. And we use those things because we do it all in-house and we're not just handing it off to another manufacturer. You know, being able to build something for us, the A side or the outside of the bike is what everyone sees. And obviously the finish quality is really important for us, but the B side, the inside of the bike for us is equally important. And that starts with the quality of our tooling, the quality of how we get carbon compaction. So we think if you look on the inside of the bike, should be demonstrative of the quality of the bike. And we think that relates also on the performance side to weight, to ride quality. So being able to control every aspect of manufacturing and have a bike that is a phenomenal quality. You know, I for people who are not cyclists, friends of mine, I kind of talk about like point to watches, for example. It's like a Timex or a Swatch, it works pretty darn well. You know, if you just want to read time, that's great. But if you're going to spend a lot of money on a watch, and I'm actually not really a watch guy, I'm wearing an Apple Watch because I think it's functional. but if you're going to spend money on a watch, you expect that it's going to be manufactured to a much higher level than a Timex. And I think that's where the cycling industry has sort of gotten away with murder a little bit, where people will spend money on a high-end bike from a big brand and sometimes a lot of money for, let's say, a premium category that's a little lighter or a little stiffer, so they say, but it's made in the same facility as those cheaper bikes. And for us, you know, that's, I think, a big differentiator. It's like we really think, hey, the answer is nobody really needs a $10,000 bike. You know, we could all ride Shimano 105 mechanical and the stuff works great. But if you're in that category where you're going to spend money on a high-end product, we think it should be built like a high-end product.
Yeah, let's dig into this whole A-side, B-side thing, because that is, I think that's a really important point to talk about, because like I remember even NABS, the North American Handmade Bicycle Show. I mean, when that show was up and running, one of the awards that they gave out was, I think, like best composite bike or best carbon bike or whatever. And that always struck me as kind of interesting because like I don't really know how that category was judged, because you're sort of just looking at surface finish for that, right? Like you're not really doing anything about that or not really digging into like how the thing was produced, right? So for people who maybe aren't super intimately familiar with how these things are made in general, kind of just more conceptually, I mean, Frank, would you mind kind of running through a little bit more of the fundamentals of how composite frames like these are manufactured? Because it really is a lot more than just what you see on the surface of the frame, right?
Absolutely, yeah. It's actually the first bike that we ever painted. I actually got a little sad because we had been looking at carbon parts for so long and testing them and iterating on the laminate schedule. And there was so much work put into the carbon side that as soon as we painted it, I was like, oh, that's hiding everything that we just did. Like, yeah, it looks great, but man, like it's underneath, you know? So that was a weird kind of experience that I had. And even going to the MADE show last year, it was a unique experience because what we were talking about earlier before we started this podcast about steel bikes and how there's beautiful, beautiful bikes out there and there's plenty of them and it's hard to differentiate. And at that show, you know, there's some pretty incredible bikes and unique designs and a lot of different paint jobs. But when you show a carbon bike there, it's hard to differentiate yourself because it's not a steel bike. Like all the work is basically hidden, and it's you're looking at lines and curves and some small design attributes that are fundamentally what a carbon bike is, which is super clean. Whereas a lot of steel bikes, obviously they can be clean, but you can see a lot of the work underneath the paint and stuff like that, and you kind of just know what it is. It's a metal or an alloy. But getting back to your question of how it's built, so on our end, basically raw fabric comes in. So we source all of our fabric from North America. It comes in, it's prepreg. Fabric's kept frozen. It has to be frozen that way because it's prepreg, so it has the epoxy in it. We only take it out the days that we cut. So we have a autometrics cutting table. It's basically a 2D plotter, and it cuts out all of our unique pieces that go into our frame and fork. So in total, we have over 700, I think 777, which I think one of our engineers might have been aiming for the 777. So we have a lot of pieces that go into every frame, and those are all cut out from our plotter. They're all put into kits and basically assigned to a laminator, who then uses a mandrel and or a bladder and or a 3D printed mandrel basically to wrap this raw fabric around in the orientations or the laminate schedule, as we call it, that we've tested and proven to be effective. And so each part is made that way. We have about 11 distinct parts per frame. So each one is made one at a time. And then that's put into a mold, that's put into a press and cured through heat and pressure. But going back to A side, B side, in my mind, our evaluation of our laminate schedule was basically pretty, how would you call it, make it, break it. I mean, you do have aerospace companies who have the money and whatnot to have x-ray machines or some way to see through what they're making. But fundamentally with carbon, very different than an alloy or any kind of metal, is that you're making the material properties and the part all at the same time. So you're basically literally starting with fabric. It's textiles, essentially, textiles that turn into a bike. So it's literally just a sheet of fabric that ends up turning into some sort of complex geometry or a tube of very, very hard, very, very strong a composite material. I came from a lot of the metal space and fell in love with the metal world, and it's wonderful. I love CNC machines. I love making unique shapes out of metal. But at the end of the day, you just have that alloy or that metal, and that's it. It's a homogeneous material. And the thing that caught my attention with composites was again that fundamental. It's really hard to wrap your mind, at least for me. Maybe I was slow on the uptake, but that you're making the material properties. You know, if that piece that you put in there is put at a different orientation, that product is going to be fundamentally different. Like, it's not the same thing. And so everything that goes into trying to make the material work for the best results that you want for that piece is really the exciting thing about composites, because every single piece that goes into the surveyor, there's not one single piece of laminate that hasn't been thought over, iterated on. It's there for a purpose, and it's there for force transfer. It's there for a whole bunch of different reasons that we've arrived at, one through great engineering and two through making and breaking. So that's the really exciting part in my mind with composites, is that you have so much freedom in what you want to make. Of course, it's very hard with that amount of freedom. You know, if you have unlimited choices, you know, it's hard to arrive at something, but you basically just have to start and improve along the way. I mean, there's definitely no way that you make something in the first time that it works. So it's a lot of work to get to where we're at. And I guess going back to your question, sorry if I'm jumping around a bit here, but going back to your question of yes, it's geography that makes Bridge unique. But I think that is really important to spend a bit more time on that too, because, you know, fundamentally, obviously Mike and I started this, and theoretically you could pick Bridge up and put it anywhere and we could say, yeah, we're local now. But at the end of the day, obviously, you know, I was born in Toronto, raised my whole life outside of Toronto, still live outside of Toronto. So I'm Torontonian, and you know, I've got three kids, three little boys, and you know, part of my motivation is to improve the area that I'm in, and you know, I think that's part of the story and part of what gives passion to what we're doing here to make a better thing here. And I think that's obviously maybe overused by companies that are doing what we're doing, but it is essential. I mean, it's what the fabric of, no pun intended, of what the companies are that are doing it local. So I think it is a very important part of it. And you know, showing, you know, for me personally, showing my kids that this can be done, you know, showing my boys that they don't have to just go to, you know, whatever business school or you know, IT or software or whatever, just showing them that you can make stuff with your hands, and also illustrating to our employees that this is this is, you know, skill sets and craft and something that you could take on and teach other people and grow here. I think that's a big part of the story. And again, like comparing attributes of geometry or performance or da-da, like these are all things that customers and, you know, we've created something that we think people will like, but obviously this is something that they have to assess on their own. But at the end of the day, excuse the hackneyed expression, but the proof is going to be in the pudding. You know, I mean, it's yes, we can say all these things that it is, but until you ride it and feel it, I don't think a lot of those things of why we're doing it here will be fully known. And clearly we're working hard as hell to produce as quickly as we can without compromising any quality to get more people on the bikes, because, you know, that to us has been one of the more surprising things of how incredible the product is. And I could say that confidently without feeling like an arrogant prick because of the testimonials that we're getting and like the smiles on people's faces, and like it's almost completely redefining their experience of a bike frame. Like we had a testimonial the other day of like, I had no idea that a bike frame could be so like different and valuable, and this is someone who's been riding some pretty high end bikes. And so it again, it's one of those things that, you know, we're working hard as we can to get people on it, and you as well, for other people to basically say, oh yeah, like this local made stuff is something special, and Bridge has an angle on it, kind of thing, rather than saying, well, how is Bridge different than Allied, or how is Bridge different than that? It's like, oh, this is just Bridge's take on a premium locally made thing. And, you know, that's what we're building here, obviously the brand around the product and the story, and definitely assume and believe that, you know, there's a market for it and a market for others as well.
I know in previous conversations that I'd had with you, one of the things that really kind of resonated and kind of stuck in my head was the last time I was here, one of the things that you had mentioned before, and I can't remember if this is something I asked you about or whatever, but we were talking about how you go about finding the right people to work here. Because I think the last time I asked you, I think you said you had what, like 12, 14 people here?
14,
like that?
Yeah.
Okay. So aside from the fact that you are located someplace where Cervelo used to be based, so there is kind of this very serendipitous, I guess, you know, concentration of people with composites knowledge and bicycle manufacturing experience and that sort of thing. But for me, when I think about, you know, the idea of having the right person for a particular role, like I've always had the idea that you can pretty often teach someone just about anything, or someone can learn just about anything. But it's always felt like there are certain kind of ingrained attributes that are much, much harder to adapt or change. What do you look for when you bring people in here?
Yeah, really good question. I mean, it's kind of an ongoing learning experience too, because, you know, you're not going to get it right every time, that's for sure. But one of the main things we want are people who are naturally driven to make nice things, attention to detail, are naturally driven to just produce, really. And that's on everything, whether it's front office or back. We have a very casual culture here, but it's made up of people who constantly want to do better and constantly want to make things and are proud of them, and would be totally proud signing their name to those travelers that you've seen around. And they take pride in the fact that they did that work. In order to find that person, it's tough. It's it is a series of interviews, a series of not background checks, what do you call it, references, and making sure that other people have had good experiences with them. Having trial weeks, kind of seeing how they, one, like it, seeing how they blend with the rest of the people. And two, part of that process for us, it's unbelievably important to figure out what that person's doing on their spare time. We almost always hire people who are going home and working on something in their garage, or have passion projects on the side. People who are really just into making things. And that's incredibly important for us because especially in composites, but I think in all things manufacturing, if you care about what you're making, attention to detail is everything, and it's all process control, and you have to, in all steps of the way, deeply care about every step. Because at the end of the day, you fundamentally don't actually know what you're making unless you make it to the spec that you tested and proved. And so all of the processes that we have throughout our shop are basically trying to enforce that, but at the end of the day, it comes down to the people doing the work. And so it's very, very important for us from a cultural perspective, and also finding the right people to have that fit of passion to make, and passion to be proud of what they're making. And, you know, it sometimes you have hard personalities where they are very proud of their work and they want a bit more control over it than others. But everyone comes with their pluses and minuses. In my mind, I'd way rather have someone who's too proud of their work and they want it to be theirs in many respects before it's the customer's, I think is really important.
Without delving too much into like personal details or information or anything like that, it seems like, you know, you could put out a job posting for like, you know, hey, we're looking for people who have experience building carbon fiber bicycle frames. Like that would obviously be very pretty easy, straightforward thing to look for. I get the impression that you more often than not would have someone come in here to do something who likely has no direct experience doing that very specific task. But, you know, I've been here twice now and talked to a bunch of people who work here. It does seem pretty clear to me that, you know, all the people that I've talked to, they do have like kind of this obvious sense of pride in what they're doing. Can you give me some examples of someone who's here, who's maybe been here for a little while, who, you know, maybe didn't have quite that direct experience that, you know, that's related to the very specific role that they're in, but actually turned out to be really good at it because they had those qualities? Like, what did they like to do out? Like, what were their hobbies that kind of gave you that indication that they might be good at this?
Yeah, so we have one coworker named Jones who came with zero experience in composites. He's a Nigerian fellow who is a musician, had made a lot of epoxy tables, so he was into making things. Obviously, he's very creative on the musical side. We have a few musicians actually, so it's not like their hobbies have to be directly related to composites. It's just more so that kind of creator hustle, I could say. And he had no experience, and now he's making some of our more complex parts. And it's about a year later, and just excelling in that front and teaching new employees who come in how to do the trade. And again, we started very tech heavy. Our engineers were our first hires. Did that one? I think it was necessary because we are local. We can't really waste money on production, even though you kind of have to as you scale, but it's towards a certain direction. But our goal was basically to dial in the technical as much as we possibly could so that we could have more freedom in hiring people that actually fit the culture and fit type of person that we want, who then can follow the technical instructions essentially to make that thing. So that's been our focus. So we're not totally tied to hiring people with experience. If I had total choice of the candidate, like a magic wand of hiring, I would say 49% is their capabilities. And then, that would be my choice on, okay, like they're capable. And then 51% would be, how do they fit in with what we want and their mentality towards learning and doing and knowing that you can make mistakes of integrity, but not mistakes of negligence, and that we expect that, and we expect that kind of growth, and we expect that kind of experimentation. And there's sometimes when our junior engineers will be like, oh, I've got an idea, and we'll talk about it, and we'll have a culture of like trying to help them, but at the same time it's like, well, go prove it out. Like, go do it and see if it works, and then come back with the proper amount of data. And so, yes, there's that amount, that side of freedom and lateral movement, but at the same time, you're expected to know what you're doing and come back with an answer that doesn't just lead to more answers or more questions or more like basically just the scientific approach, I guess. But I mean, it's, that expectation is there. So yes, you have that freedom to do those things, but you're also expected to perform at a really, really high level. And in essence, like, we've never actually had a job posting. Mostly hunted down the people that we're interested in, just on basically online resume searches, and just trying to find those qualities that we're looking for in their resumes that kind of pop out as something that's special for us. And again, a small amount of that is their actual experience, and a lot of it's in their skill sets and in their hobbies and how they emphasize certain things in their resume. And so we've kind of cold called most of the people.
Interesting.
Yeah. And then the other portion has been people recommending their friends. And so we've had, again, people, as far as I know, hopefully no one's lying to me, they love working here. It is a really fantastic environment, and they've been able to bring in people from their old jobs or whatever it is to come and help. And so that's been a big help for us too.
Yeah, so you forgot that you were going to get cut off, right? Well, sorry, I've always been a big believer in keeping promises, and that includes the one I made at the beginning of the show. So if you want to get the rest of this episode of Geek Warning and every other special episode of Geek Warning, along with everything else we produce here at Escape Collective, head over to escapecollective.com to sign up. It's super quick and easy, and you can be back here in less than 5 minutes. Just remember to choose Geek Warning when we ask you why you signed up. Doesn't really change anything on my end, but, well, it does kind of give the Geek Warning crew some bragging rights. So, all right, well, see you back here in a few.